I don't know if you've ever been in these situations before where you're kind of cornered in front of a large group of people and asked a question that makes you feel uncomfortable. I think probably most of us at some level have been asked a question, maybe not in a crowd of people and asked to answer it, but maybe in a group setting or somebody asks you something that you kind of takes you off guard. I'll never forget being interviewed by a church one time. It was a youth ministry position, and it, you know, the typical ministry interviews, which are always so awkward. I mean, let's be honest. You know, you bring this guy in, you put him on a stage, you ask him to do a song and dance thing for a Sunday, and then you're supposed to figure out, you know, is he really the guy that we need? It's just kind of humorous to me how we do this. But anyway, I was doing my song and dance, you know, and and we had gotten done. You can laugh, it's okay. It's humorous. But we had gotten done our morning, and we had had a potluck fellowship meal afterwards. Every church does this, right? And and it's a Q&A session afterwards with all the teen families. And I was not given a heads up about this guy. I got a lot of apologies afterwards, like, he always does that. We're sorry. But anyway, this is one individual in the crowd who asked me several questions that were a little bit more probing than the standard, well, what's your favorite ice cream flavor, you know? He asked me, I think, a couple scenarios in which, you know, how would you respond to this? So one of the scenarios that he threw out there to me was, you know, you're a youth minister, you're doing your job, and you're getting involved with the teens, and you're really connecting with some of these people, and then you start to notice that one of the girls really is attached to you. And seems to really connect well with you. And then, and she just kind of keeps going along with this, and basically the girl has a crush on you. What do you do? I'm like, well, I mean, I guess, I don't know, you know. So I answered that one. Well, the next scenario was, what do you do if, you know, you find out that somebody in the youth group is, their parents are alcoholics? How do you handle that? And I mean, man, it's like, I'm sweating up here, you know. I just wanted to answer some, you know, just gentle lobs, you know, softball kind of stuff. Not fastball. I didn't know we were playing hard yet. But anyway, this guy genuinely was concerned, obviously, as you probably imagine, about the youth minister, how he's going to relate to the church, and what kind of scenarios might a youth minister find himself in, which some of those happen, right? But I remember sweating bullets. That was my first interview anywhere of any church, and just trying to figure out, how do I answer these questions? Well, in Mark chapter 10, Jesus has one of these conversations. He often, it seems, through the Gospels, has these conversations with the Pharisees. They'll come up and they'll ask him this question, put him on the spot in front of a bunch of people, and just kind of see what happens. And I love Jesus because he's just this masterful, has this presence about him, it seems like, from how he responds to these things. He doesn't seem to get flustered. And so the Pharisees come up in chapter 10, starting verse 2, and they ask him this question. Trying to trip him up, they say, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And boy, if you want to hit a hot button topic, just talk about divorce. And in a crowd of that size, no doubt there were people that had dealt with this issue. We're currently dealing with this issue, had mixed feelings about this issue. It wasn't like they all felt the same way, thought the same thing about this topic. And so this is a hot potato, you know, pass it off as soon as you can kind of thing. Matthew chapter 19 is the parallel passage to Mark 10. In Matthew's account, he adds that there's a phrase that they put at the end of this question. The Pharisees also ask, is it lawful to divorce a man, for a man to divorce his wife without cause? And really, if you go back into history, at this time in Jewish worship and Jewish life, there was a divide, believe it or not, over how to interpret the law's prohibition of divorce. What are some things that are allowed? What are some things that are not allowed? There was one group under a teacher named Hillel who basically was the liberal side of the argument. They said you can divorce your wife for any cause, it doesn't matter. And then there was another guy named Shammai that was more conservative, said no, it's only limited to sexual immorality, immodest behavior, this kind of thing. So the Pharisees are trying to suck Jesus in to the current debate, the politics of religious interpretation, right? And Jesus, though, is so masterful. He's smarter than that, right? And he does something that, by the way, if you're ever asked a question that you're uncomfortable asking, you always answer with another question. Which is what Jesus does. He says, well, what did Moses command? But Jesus just, He's not really trying to get out of answering the question. He wants to dig a little deeper here. What he's trying to help them to understand and do is to go back to the intent. What did Moses want you to do when he received the law from God? And the Pharisees say, well, Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to send her away quietly. Believe it or not, some of these divorce laws in the first century Judaism were pretty liberal. That one group under that guy named Hillel that I just mentioned basically said that the teacher himself said that if your wife cooks you a meal improperly, it's grounds for divorce. Some people are chuckling about that, right? Only, by the way, was it a man's right to divorce in this world, unfortunately. But nonetheless, it was a thought. It was out there. It wasn't like it was an outlying assumption. It was a very well-established thought that this was allowable. And Jesus says, no. That's not what I asked. I didn't ask, what did Moses allow you to do? I said, what did Moses command? And he goes on to say, it's because of the hardness of your heart that he wrote you this commandment. And then he goes back to this quote from Genesis 2, where he says that from the beginning it was not like this. From the beginning, God created them male and female. There's this diversity to express the fullness of the image of God. And let me take a tangent here, but it's not really a tangent. It's an important one. Because Jesus hits on something about marriage that is foundational to our understanding the Christian ideal of marriage that you won't find anywhere else. Genesis 1 talks about man being created in the image of God. Male and female. Both of us share and bear the image of God. But you know what? We're different. If you're married, you especially know we're different, right? It doesn't take you very long to understand there are fundamental, inherent differences between a male and a female. I don't respond to life the same way my wife responds to life, nor does she respond to situations in the way that I do. She has qualities and characteristics that I don't possess. Just the same as I do of those that she does not. And we can speak in generalities here because fundamentally there are qualities and things that we as males and you as females possess that we don't until we share it together in a marriage. And the fundamental reason in Scripture for not allowing something like a homosexual marriage, union of a same-sex couple, is that it goes against the very expression of marriage that was to begin with. Because in marriage, male and female coming together, there is a full expression of the image of God that you won't find anywhere else. Because when we come together as male and female in a union, in a marriage relationship, we express all that there is to express about the image of God that by ourselves, on our own, we cannot. And so it's not simply because it's wrong, it's actually fundamentally a reflection of God's character that marriage should be heterosexual. And a man and a woman. Only a man and a woman can join together in the creation of children with God as He created the world. Right? And so we share as females and males this ability to participate in God's work through creation, through reflection of His image. And so Jesus says, it goes back to the beginning here, that God created them this way, male and female. And He says, therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, hold fast to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. Now, some of us just gloss right over that and don't give a second thought to what Jesus is really saying. Jesus has used now an explicit sexual reference in the marriage relationship. The one flesh union is the sexual union of a man and woman. This term, one flesh, is to be no mistake as Jesus is talking about it, what He's actually referencing here. And so it's interesting that in a discussion about what's allowable in divorce, a separation of the union, a breaking of the fellowship and the relationship, that Jesus says, no, in the beginning it was not supposed to be this way. In the beginning you were supposed to be one. God's desire was for intimacy, not divorce. And so he ends, "What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." Jesus is essentially saying, I don't even know why you're asking me this question. What's allowable? Because really, there's nothing that's allowable. It was always supposed to be one flesh. You can't separate them when they're together. Many of you might have... this parallel passage kind of runs in together with this. Matthew chapter 19. Jesus continues on and basically says the only reason, scripturally, if you're talking about a reason here, the only reason to divorce anyone would be for unfaithfulness, sexual immorality. Because essentially at that point the marriage bond has been broken. The union that was supposed to be is now no longer. If you remember the movie Fireproof, there's a movie that came out several years ago. It was a Christian movie about marriage. And in the movie, this character, Caleb Holt is his name. He's a captain on the fire team in his town. His marriage is falling apart. He's not a Christian, kind of far from God character. And in the movie, he has lots of ongoing conversations with a friend of his, Michael Simmons, who's also on the fire department. And Michael's a Christian. And so Michael is trying to help him through his failing marriage, and he is having these discussions. And in one particular poignant scene, they're sitting at a table in the break room at the fire station, and they're having a discussion about Caleb's impending divorce. And Michael's trying to wrestle with how to explain this, like what you're about to do with this divorce. What's going to happen in your life if you go through with this? And he sees a pair of salt and pepper shakers on the table. He says, "Give me those salt and pepper shakers." He digs around in the drawer for some super glue that they had on hand. And Caleb's looking at Michael like, "What are you doing?" And he glues the two together, presses them, holds them for a minute, and then gives them back to Caleb. "Try to get them apart," he says. Caleb's looking at it, trying to do it gently. And then he starts to go like this. He says, wait, you can't do that. Because you're going to break one or both of them. The design for our lives as married people is to join. And when there's a break, when there's a divorce, when there's a separation, when there's sexual immorality that comes into play in a marriage relationship, it inevitably serves to sever the ties of union that were designed to keep us together. And so a healthy family, if we're talking about the family that you've always wanted, and healthy families, husbands and wives, relate intimately together. And so if you looked at it like a spectrum, on one side you have divorce, marriage, and a spectrum. On one side there's divorce, on the other there's intimacy. Healthy marriages relate this way, on the intimate side, because not only is it one flesh sexually, but one flesh carries over into every aspect of our lives. Have you ever wondered how it is that older couples, you ever look at an older couple and realize that they look like the same? It's like, are you guys related? Or actually, there was one couple that actually did this. They were so worried because they kept getting this question, are you guys related? Are you brother or sister? Nobody could figure out they were married, and so they actually began to worry. Are we related? They got genetic testing to make sure before they started the family that we're not related. But this actually happens. It's not merely a joke. It actually does happen. People have studied this. Why do married couples, the longer that they live, begin to look more alike? In 1987, the University of that place up north did a study on this. Yeah. Andrew gave me a thumbs up right there. They did a study on this, and what they found is fascinating. What they found is that older married people look alike. Because in the first place, we tend to choose people that are similar to us in our likes and our looks. That's just kind of natural. You have a certain preference set based on your family, based on your genetics, and so you typically choose people that have some of the same qualities and characteristics physically as you do. That's the first thing. But as you go through life together, what they found is that these experiences that we have as married couples age our faces in the same way. You create the same laugh lines, the same stress lines, the same wrinkles, the same creases as your spouse because you're experiencing life together in the same way. And as many of you who have been married long enough know that you begin to imitate each other and the facial expressions that you have throughout life. It's inevitable as long as you live with somebody that you'll start to take on qualities and characteristics and different responses to similar scenarios that your spouse would have. And so it is a fact for many couples that the longer they live together, the more they tend to favor each other. As we grow in marriage, our likes and our dislikes, our time and our effort continue to grow together. You ever notice how happily married older people love doing things together? I think that could be funny, maybe. So, you know, the husband's going shopping with his wife, but if you talk to him by himself, he really doesn't enjoy shopping very much, let's be honest. But he wants to be with his wife, so they enjoy shopping. Or a wife goes to a weekend race with her husband. She could care less about cars. She just wants to be with her husband. I've talked to some of you wives whose husbands fish. You're like, I really don't care to fish. I just want to be with my husband. And so you share these experiences together. The one flesh aspect of marriage is not just sexual, it's life itself. As we grow in marriage together. Healthy couples allow time for each other. They respect and value each other. They don't put down or make fun of each other, especially when the other's not around. They listen to the heart of their spouse and they give to each other. But there's another layer here, and I want to go a little deeper and dig a little bit more. Because what Jesus is saying here is to a crowd that is very different than us. In ministry, you inevitably deal with marriage, and often one of the objections is someone's getting ready to have a divorce or they're just questioning their marriage. They'll say things like, well, he's just not the person I married. You ever heard that one? She's changed. And let's be honest, life changes us, you know? We often do change over time, and we become someone maybe that we weren't before. But oftentimes you'll hear these objections as to, and I'm not sure, the next statement might be, and I'm not sure what to do with that, or I'm not sure if I can be married to him anymore or her anymore, and I'm not sure if we're compatible together, if maybe this is just our parting of ways now. I want to give you something to think about. In Jesus' day, first century Jewish life, the average couple married would have been put together by mom and dad. Jesus is speaking to a bunch of people who are likely in arranged marriages. They didn't date and go to the movies on Friday night and get to know each other for a couple years before they got married. Their parents were like, hey, I have a son. He's 18. You have a daughter. She's 16, 15. You think they'd be interested in getting together? Maybe we could get them together in a marriage. And I know this sounds so offensive to us in our culture, doesn't it? Oh my goodness, you know, where was the free choice? There was free choice. You could always refuse, in many cases, those unions together if the couple involved just really didn't want to have any part in this. There was always that choice. But you have to understand something about their culture. In an honor and shame culture, the honor of obeying and respecting and valuing your family and your parents' wishes often placed above personal desire and wishes. And so the desire to honor mom and dad, honor our families, honor our parents together, would have often trumped the personal desire for this person or another. They may have known each other, right? They probably weren't complete strangers, but the likelihood that they dated, had any sort of ideas about love before they got married is pretty minimal. In fact, the idea of dating at all is a modern phenomenon that we've come up with, less than 100 years old. Your great-great-great-grandparents probably didn't do this. And so Jesus is talking to a bunch of people who were married likely without love. But you got married, and you stayed married. But the work of marriage and intimacy came later. And it took time and effort. And it didn't happen overnight. And the reality for them, for us, is that intimacy takes work. It's not a simple thing. It's not a weekend marriage retreat that'll fix it all. It's not a visit to the counselor's office that'll fix it all. It's not a it takes years. Jesus is calling this group of people to intimacy that did not start in the same place that you and I did when we got married. I'm sure that most of us, if I talked to you and you shared with me how you met your wife, how you met your husband, and what you did and how you got together, you know, there would be some really cool stories about how you dated and how you knew each other before marriage. And I'm not suggesting that we go back to this model, by the way. I'm not suggesting that you arrange your children's marriages, although you may want to, but or that you try to, you know, marry somebody without knowing them. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying some of these objections that we give and these hesitancies that we have would have been foreign to Jesus' audience. Because where they started from was very different from where you and I did. But here's the great news. The great news about this is that intimacy is possible. If Jesus can call a group of people who were in arranged marriages, most of them, to intimacy, how much more you and I? Who at some point in your marriage, if you aren't at this place right now, there was a time where you loved your spouse deeply and you felt connected to them. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gotten married. And so uncovering all of that is part of the return to intimacy that Jesus is talking about. He says it takes work. Nothing is impossible with God. When we understand that God has wired us for intimacy with our marriage partner, and when we understand that the work and the pursuit of intimacy, and I'll say it like that because it's a pursuit of intimacy in marriage, is the only way to a satisfying marriage. Not finding the right one, because that's often what we think. Well, I just have to go out and find the right one and then I'll be happy. And the reality is that that right one eventually will require work too, both of you. When we find our understanding of the pursuit of intimacy, we will be able to live with each other in the way God intended, as man and wife, and experience all the benefits of a healthy marriage. You remember what the Proverbs writer encourages his son in the early chapters of Proverbs, Proverbs 5? He says, "Rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breast satisfy you always. Be intoxicated always by her love." He's talking to a young man who is tempted in the passage to go find intimacy with someone else, because it seems like at the moment that it's easier that way. And it often does seem easier in our lives as we're married. Inevitably, somebody comes along in your life and you think, well, I wonder what it'd be like to be married to them. When things are tough, when things are rough between your spouse and you, it seems like the easy way out, the best way out, may be with somebody else, and that might be the only solution. But the father in Proverbs 5 says, no. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. And so the question I want to leave you with this morning: can you say your marriage is one of intimacy? And intimacy in the fullest experience, not simply sexual in nature, but all realms of intimacy, closeness together. If you answered no, can I ask you another question? Are you pursuing intimacy together? And I know there's often the conversation, well, yes, but they're not, or she's not, or he's not doing it. And no, I'm asking you. I understand. Sometimes it is the other person's fault. Sometimes they're not in the right. But this morning, I want to ask you, are you pursuing intimacy with your spouse? We can only control ourselves and what we choose to do in a given scenario. If you can't answer yes to those questions, the church is here to support you in your marriage, which is why we're doing what we're doing next week with family. We value the importance of marriage because we understand fundamentally how it connects us with the reflection of the image of God in the fullest sense. And so this morning, if you need in any way help, prayers related to the topic or unrelated to the topic, if you need to make today the day that you decide to follow Christ, in any reason, in any way, we'd love to help you out. We're going to sing another song here in a moment. Keith's going to get up and lead us in another song. And we'd invite you to come as we stand and sing that song together.